Welcome to the Protectors Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Piccolo.
Hey, I'd like to welcome to the show, Pete Turner. How you doing, Pete?
Man, I'm awesome. Thank you so much for having me on. I can't tell you what it means to me. It's incredible to have these conversations.
Yeah, same here. I mean, that's the thing is like, you are now, I always say this every time I have a guest, I'm like, you're now my 12th guest. And the types of guests I've been getting and just the stories that they're telling are absolutely amazing to me. And I really appreciate you guys coming on.
Yeah, it's the same thing for me. My life is deeply enriched by through my show and the interviews that I get to have. I've made so many new friends. And, you know, it's one thing to network, but I've exploded my network in a meaningful fashion. And being able to do this to me is wonderful.
Well, that's the thing about your background. It's such a diverse background. And now the way I found you in a way, you know, you've been helping me out for a while with podcasting. You know, as soon as I started this thing, you could tell the difference between my audio in episode one to my audio now. And then I'm sure after this one, my audio is going to be a lot better because you're going to be like, hey, Jason, you got to do this.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, we're all chasing that, you know, Rob Nyer is a friend of mine now. And I read his stuff for years as a sports writer for ESPN. And he just started his podcast and he's like, I want to know what you think. And I'm like, I'm going to tell you what I think, you know, and I'm going to, cause we all want the same thing. We all want to not sound like crap. And I mean that in terms of the content, but also the quality of the audio.
And the audio is a huge thing because I know a lot of people listen in their cars, they listen in their headsets, and it's like, if you have bad audio, it lasts literally 2 minutes before you switch to another podcast.
Yeah. There can't be tolerance for that. Yeah.
No, and I think, and you know, just as I do podcasts is like kind of like the wave of what it is now. You know, the short soundbite news and everything else just doesn't work. People are trying to get real content now, which is awesome.
Yeah, one of the best things about what I do is we had Lorenzo Lamas on today, and you can say, oh yeah, he was an actor and make some jokes or whatever, but the fact is he's a real dude. He's a dad.
He is.
And he's had to transition in his life, and he's not primarily an actor now, and he takes on roles, but he's just like everybody else is figuring it out. He's been on the edge of survival financially, and you can't capture that in 7 minutes. There's just no way.
No, exactly. And you can't get it from a tweet. You can't get it from a Facebook post. And I think that's why a lot of people are grasping this podcasting. And I love this show because I like to do, my regular life, it gets so political sometimes. I like to just sit down and talk to vets, LEOs, first responders, people just kind of do their thing and just kind of talk.
Yeah, get some perspective. One of the things that I've always done with my work as a spy and everything else is I've tried to figure out like what reality is for that person and share that with whoever the client is, you know. And sometimes it's like, so I'll give you an example as a spy, as someone who's out in the field every day trying to find things out. I knew I was doing my job when the locals would ask for me and say, we want to explain something to you, you know, or like when the Iraqi general is, where's my advisor? And they're talking about me. And he's like, I need to understand culture better.
Exactly. And that's Spy 101. Cause you know, I used to be in a dope game. I used to work the narcotic stuff, flipping sources and all this stuff. That's Spy 101. But you know, before we get into that, we kind of probably should tell everybody kind of who you are and where you came from. Oh, so let's go all the way back. So where did you grow up in?
I grew up in the Bay Area in California, just this little tiny town that used to be the capital, and it's gorgeous. It sits right on the confluence of the Delta for Central California and the Bay. We're just that point where it sort of turns. It's called Benicia, and it's just your perfect little California town.
I love it. Now, is that kind of, were you anywhere near Monterey at the time?
Monterey is north of me, and we're not on the coast. We're on the interior part, on the edge of the bay. So we're 35 miles from the coast due west from us. So we can get there fast, but north of Monterey by quite a ways.
Oh, because I'm trying to get there. How did you get in there? So you get out of high school, and then did you join the military right after that?
No, I went to college first. I graduated, got a BA, all that kind of thing.
Oh, what was your BA in?
Mass communication, TV and radio.
Okay. I'm trying to get to where we get into the military intelligence. How do you become a military intelligence guy? And how do you become an army spy, as they like to call it?
Yeah, it's funny. I failed at finding a job in TV and radio. You know, at the time, it just was the economy, you know, it's one of those dips where there just weren't a lot of jobs. And then also, to be fair, like, we were expanding the TV radio game to not just be white dudes. So, you know, I just like, hey, this just isn't working out. I couldn't find jobs even like carrying a camera. So one day I was pushing the shopping carts in the rain at Costco, and I'm like, I got to do something else. You know, I don't have any experience. I can't get experience. So let me go to a place that will. I tested well, and you know how this goes. If you test good at all, like the military's test in general is not designed to determine how smart you are. It's like, you know, what level job can you take? And once you get past a certain level of success in the test, pretty much any job is available to you. And so I explained to my recruiter, I'm like, I don't want to be inside all the time. I don't want to be outside. I want something cool, you know, and he's like, you want to be a spy. And so he gave me this job, and I'm the one guy that's like, my recruiter did perfect.
Thank God for that, man. And so that was 97 Bravo back in the day, right? So this was
97 B.
93, yep. 94 is when you went in?
Yeah, 94. We even did like the full like surveillance track course, and we did everything. You know, you don't learn anything, but you learn about what you're going to do in the Army. So I was very fortunate to catch the very tail end of the surveillance stuff, because that's proven to be very important in my career.
No, it is, exactly. And that's one technique that you have to actually learn in the field. You can't teach that in a classroom, that's for sure.
No.
And it's almost OJT, you know, OJT, on the job training. So, you did a tour in Bosnia as well, right?
Yeah. I deployed in Bosnia in 96 with the first big wave that came through, you know, the first like big army wave, not the initial stuff, but yeah, 96.
So that's your first real like experience using your craft.
Yeah, boy, they tried to train us on what to do, you know, and you know how this goes. So like, here's the winter driving video. Every day we're going to train hard, so we're all prepared. And they're like, okay, cool. And the next day came in, and they're like, here's the winter driving video. And you're like, well, why don't we just go drive in winter conditions? It's Germany outside. No. And so we must have watched that winter driving video 10 times. And I'm not even lying. They would like, oh, we lost the roster. They literally did not know how to train us, because that wasn't our job. Our job was to go out and do background investigations for top secret clearances. That was our job. And so we were getting rid of M16s because we were going to never need them again. And the interrogators in our unit, they were going to shut down their company because we were never going to need interrogators again. And so we deployed. I was one of the few people that still had an M16 instead of a pistol, an M9. But I literally had very little idea on what to do. My boss was a warrant officer, but she was an interrogator. And then my other boss was brand new to the unit. And thankfully, he had had some ability to do the work. And he put it all on my partner and I, a couple of E4s. He's like, you guys are going to cut your teeth right here. And we're going to talk to thousands of people. And we did.
No, that's exactly what you did, because I know my wife was one of those interrogators that went over back then, and that's what it is. It's like when you're an MI or military intelligence, you're talking to people. That's your life. That's human intelligence. Yeah. And you can kind of tell, you know, because I've been tracking your career since I started this podcast, and I can kind of tell that, you know, a lot of your background of who you became was because you were doing human.
So it's all a spy game, and, you know, and people like, you can't just say spy, you're not really a spy. I'm like, of course I'm a spy. Like, my job is to go out every single day and talk to people and build a network and have information flow through me to somebody else who put it together. And most people can't do that. They can't go out every day and meet people and I reject my own reality. This was the big professional lesson I had to learn. I have to reject my own reality. I have to reject what the commander tells me I'm supposed to find. I'm aware of that, and it's important to me, but it's not important to me, because what I find out, no one else can find out. No one else even knows what questions to ask. And that's always going to be more powerful than anything else. So if I'm going to go out every single day and find new things out and bring it back to somebody and say, here's what I saw today, it has to be something that's going to change how we all at the headquarters see how the fight is going.
And that is called vetted intelligence. That's, you know, you have to, and a lot of people like to, you know, the audience of the Protectors podcast is kind of all over, but you know, a lot of us, almost everybody has interaction with other human beings. And that's exactly what spycraft and tradecraft is just talking to other people and gathering intelligence. That's kind of what a policeman does. That's what a special agent does. Firemen do it. Everybody does it. You have to find out what the real situation is. And 9 times out of 10, the only way you're going to find that real situation is talking to a real person.
Yeah, and I always tell everybody, like, well, what do you do? How do you do it? Here's what I do. I go out and I talk to people. And if you walked with me every day, first off, you would see how hard I work, because I'm out every single day. And I'll get into the other parts of this, but just that being out is a fraction. It's the tip of the iceberg. And then if you watched me work, like, he's just talking to people all the day. He's getting drunk. He's eating chicken and all these other things. But in reality, there's quite a bit of tradecraft going on and very adept massaging of conversations. Let me see if I can say this right. I'm as not in control of a conversation as I can be while still being completely in control of that conversation. It's a very loose, no saddle ride with a horse, and I'm hanging on to the mane, but I know exactly what I'm doing.
Well, yeah, you know the end state. You know where you want to go, and you kind of know how to get there, but you're just kind of playing with it as you go.
That's it. That's it right there. Yeah. And then the other thing, like I was saying, the tip of the iceberg, you know, because I'm a small element, it's often just by myself, I've got to do my own pre-planning. I've got to figure out how I'm going to ask my questions, which is a massive endeavor of work. And then also there's all the post stuff. I've got to write a report, figure out what I'm going to do next, and try to figure it all out, because sometimes, yeah, I try not to do my own analysis because that's not really my job. But the reality is I have to do my own analysis so I can do my job better.
And yeah, you're the only one to explain what you actually talk to someone else about. So when those intel analysts get it, they kind of have to know what the background of it is.
Yeah. I've got to build a little bit of analysis. So every report, and this is the primary, I built a report format for what I did. And I built that by talking to colonels and understanding what they wanted to know. And basically, it's three parts. It's like a who, what, where, when, why, how boilerplate of what happened, what the nature of the mission was. And then there's what I saw or what I heard, you know. And keep in mind, this is all done through a translator, that kind of thing. So this is not verbatim, but I'm going to do my best to give you a gist. And then it's what I think it means. And that part is the hardest part, because you're writing for an audience that can go as high as the very top, the president's desk, ultimately. So you're trying to write something that is clear, concise, true. And then you do read elements of your report from higher reports where they coalesce things. And you're like, that's not what I was trying to say. Because they just take one element from it that confirms things. And you're just like, no. So understanding how to write a great report is, it's an artwork. I don't know how to do it any better than I do it. And I know I'm no good at it.
Nobody's good at writing reports, especially in the beginning of your career.
Oh boy. Yeah.
So you get out of the Army, and then what did you do after that? Now you already have a 4-year degree. You've already done a deployment. Do you go right? Do you work for DOD, or do you like, hey, you know what? I have a certain set of skills. How do I use these?
Well, I want to skip ahead, because I do want to cover this. By no design of anybody up top, my next job after deploying and running sources was, and I'm, when I say running sources, you know, I'm saying this to you, so you, because you understand this, actual like recorded sources, you know, like recruited and everything. I went to the school that taught that in the Army, and they're like, hey, congratulations. And I'm like, you know, I just did this. And only a few people would know this, because of course it's all classified stuff. And so I would tell my boss, who's another spy, and we're all arrogant. He's like, yeah, whatever. You're here to do the computers. I don't know anything about computers, but I'm like, got it. I'm the computer guy. Perfect. And, you know, and slowly but surely I had to re-earn my way in, but I taught other spies how to do spy stuff. I ran all over Tombstone playing roles. I'm the mayor, that kind of thing. And you know how all this stuff goes. But the funny thing is that never happens. It never happens that you come back with fresh field notes and go and teach your peers. So I'm teaching. I literally taught two warrant officers who were above me in my previous unit. And they're like, does anybody know that you know how to do this here? And I'm like, they think I'm the computer guy. And they thought it was hilarious. So not only am I teaching guys who are way higher in rank than me, but they also knew, like, they knew my work. So they had respect for me, and I wasn't a jerk. It's hilarious. So I got to do that. And that actually somehow magically paid the bills later on directly when I was in Iraq.
Well, and you bring up a good point, because this was the 90s. This was, you know, the only real conflict we had, a major conflict, was Desert Storm.
Right.
Then Bosnia, we did have a lot of elements there, but it wasn't like, there wasn't a ton of MI going on. So you come back, you're a subject matter expert, and yeah, you know, E4, E5, E6, and people just are like, hey, you know what? I've been in the Army for 20 years. What do you know, kid?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. Yeah. So you're in, your service is up. What happens next? I mean, this is pre 9/11. What were you doing right before 9/11?
I was working in insurance on the business side of it, not the agent side of it. And so my job was to assess risk, but it didn't go well. Honestly, like whatever move I thought I was supposed to make, they're like, wrong move. That's the exact opposite. You know, so you have this guy who's this, you know, it took me a long time to recognize this, but because I'm so independent and don't need much supervision, if you say, go do this as best you can, I'm gonna. And the thing, for like the first 8 months that I was at this insurance place, I didn't really have a job. They're like, there's not much you can really do until we go through training. So just try to learn. And so I'm like, oh, okay, I will. And I read, like, there was this whole like advanced level program that they had all the books there for. It was like 11 book multi-volume set. And it was just enormous. And I'm like, I'm just going to read that. And so every day I read that and read that and read that. And I didn't know what I was reading, but, you know, I was educating myself. And my boss is like, where did you go all day? I'm like, well, you guys told me you're not going to keep track of my times. I'd be like, I'm going to go out to lunch. And you guys quit telling me that. So I'm like, okay, I'll quit telling you that. So I would go outside and I would read and I would read and I would read and I was learning. And I'm like, well, I read every one of those 11 books from that license thing. He's like, why would you do that? I'm like, well, you said to educate myself. And so I did. And he's like, I don't want you doing that. And I'm like, okay, great. And it was just a series of those things where we just could never figure each other out. And I don't know, I needed something to do. So I joined the reserves. My ex-wife, and she was also in the Army. She's like, I think I might join the reserves. And I'm like, you know, I'll look into it too. And so I did. And I came back in, and this is the reserves for you. I was in Illinois at the time. They're like, yeah, there's no intel slots at all, but you could come back in as an 88 November, basically like the guy that manages the truck drivers. And so I'm like, you know what? Whatever. And the guy's like, sign up like this, and I'm sure that they'll have somebody close by, because there's units for intel, and they're always going to be shorthanded, but I can't bring you in for that. And he was 100% right. I transferred over into intel with inside of a year, maybe. But I was still in that transportation unit when 9/11 happened, and that changed everything.
No, it absolutely did. And you and I kind of have a similar background. I was combat arms, and then I in a guard when I got out. I joined a human, and I was doing CI stuff up until I commissioned as an infantry guy, which is I don't know what I'm thinking, but I did it. So 9/11 happens. It changed all of us.
Yeah,
you know? I mean, me being an infantry guy, I knew everybody I was going in class with was going to end up in war. I knew I'd probably end up there eventually. So you're in a transportation unit. So you had to kind of, you think something was going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I was transitioning over to MI at the time. So during the 9, so I deployed in October of 2001 to Egypt for Bright Star ultimately. And that was as a transportation guy. So I get there, and this is kind of a funny thing because I'm a spy and I'm not just going to do transportation work. I know better than that. So, and then the other funny thing was, is I came in as an E5 to the reserves, and there were two E6s. So there were two staff sergeants and me, and then a bunch of lower enlisted guys. And they said, "Hey, Pete, we've already divided up. One of us has nights, one of us has days. And then you have, you know, basically no job." Really. And they were all proud of themselves. And I'm like, man, that's the best. Thanks so much for that. And so I went over to the bulletin board and I looked for the inevitable flyer that says, come to the spy office if you see anything. And so I'm like, that's what I needed right there. So I went up over to the spy office, the counterintelligence office, and I meet this super, super, super cocky lieutenant who was having a dip. Keep in mind, at the time, I'm reading a biography of Alan Dulles, who's the master spy. And so I got this book in my hand and I walk up and I'm like, "Hey, sir," you know, I'm in uniform. And he's like, "Yeah, what can I do for you?" And I'm like, I'm a counterintelligence agent. I'm positive you guys are short staffed and I really am not gainfully employed. So if you want me, I'd love to come work with you." And he's like, yeah, whatever. And I'm like, "No, really, I swear to y'all, this is true. I know it sounds crazy, but I'm really not gainfully employed and you really can take me." And he's like, "Yeah, I don't think so." And I'm like, "I'll tell you what, let me look in the door. See, it's a small world. Maybe I'll know somebody. Who knows?" And he's like, "You know what? Sure." And he spits in his cup. You know, he's dipping. And I'm like, "By the way, why do you think I have an Alan Dulles book in my... It's like a 3-inch thick book. Why do I have this in Egypt if this isn't true?" He did not believe me at all. So I poked my head in. And as I poked my head in, I looked to the back desk. And there's a warrant officer I knew from my time at the source course. And he goes, because we all did first names there, "Pete." And I'm like, "Chief, how are you?" And he's like, "Tell me that you're here and that I can use you." And I'm like, "Absolutely." And so next thing you know, I was wearing civilian clothes every day and helping. Really not. He's like, "I got the best job. No reporting. You have no responsibility. I just want you to sort of just be like an expert and help my younger agents out because I don't have enough people to do that." And I'm like, "God, I can do that." And so he's like, "By the way, my boss works for the boss here, and he'll do whatever I tell him. So you don't have to worry about your transpo guys." And so when I came back and reported back to my transportation sergeant, I said, "Hey, man, I got another job. I got to go." That guy was mad as hell.
I'm sure you're their backup when they wanted to go sham.
Yeah, totally.
Now, and that's the greatest thing about all of this is it's, and MI is like such a small world. And that probably progressed you onto your next career.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at some point I had to go do something else because I was, you know, like, and this will sound arrogant to some people, but it's just true. I'm too good at war to not be out and doing it and have somebody else do it, especially because I knew most of the people that were coming in weren't getting the level of education that I had in this. You know, it was, like you said, it was the 90s right before this. And so we weren't sure what to train for. And I just had a big jump on a lot of people at all of my time working, you know, doing thousands of interviews before I even got started. And then I went and I taught other people how to do interviews and conversations. I was just too good to sit around. So I started working on a contract and my job was to augment what was there. And what was there was, well, first off, it was nothing. We were the team. And then when the actual team showed up, they were all reclassed and God bless, but you know, they were reclassed via a video teleconference sitting in a classroom reading books. And you know how that goes. It's no preparation for combat.
And that's exactly what I did before I got commissioned is I did a correspondence courses / hey, a guy comes in, talks to you for a few days. All of a sudden I'm a CI agent. So yeah. And that's the thing is, you know, it's not arrogance. It's what you call thousands of hours of talking to people.
Man.
And it's just, and trying to, using that to teach others, it's OJT. You're actually the subject matter expert. You're telling people how to talk to these individuals in order to elicit information. So no, it's not arrogance. I think it's just kind of like, hey, look, this is who I am. And this is what I can do. And this is how I'm going to help the mission.
That's right. You know, and the thing is everybody can get there at some point. There's so much, and you know this, there's so much self-development in this field. And maybe you don't specialize in talking to people. That's turned out what I did well. Other people are great analysis people in there, and other people are great operator, like they manage operations. And we need all of those people, but you don't come out that way. You have to go out and, frankly, make a lot of mistakes. I can't think of another job that has more mistake-based learning than ours. There may be others that are comparable, but like being a helicopter mechanic, you wouldn't be a mechanic if you had to make as many mistakes as we have to make to figure out what we have to do.
And that's the thing about CI. CI is almost counterintelligence for everybody out there. It's the same thing as being a special agent. It's the same thing as being a policeman. You're always gathering intel. You're always talking to people. And rule number one, you're always making a mistake. So yeah, and you learn from your mistakes. And the only way you're going to become good at your job is if you do it for enough time and you talk to enough people. You can't just be like, okay, I graduated from A school. Now I'm a counterintelligence. I'm a spy, blah, blah, blah. You actually have to actually talk to real people with a real heartbeat. So yeah.
Yeah, and get those people to trust you. You know, like one of the things I talk about a lot is someone will say you have to build rapport and then you build trust. And then, and like they move on to the next thing. Like what you just said is extraordinarily hard to do. How do you know when you have good rapport? How do you teach someone else to have good rapport? How do you build trust? What are the elements of that? As a any kind of an infantryman, you know what your weapon can do. If I come up and I'm shooting targets and I've just got bullets going everywhere, you will tell me cheek stock weld, You know, steady position, like a firm but loose grasp of your weapon.
Exactly. You know, that's your job.
Gentle trigger squeeze. You will tell me the things that I can do to get rounds to go into a smaller area. Nobody has that for rapport and trust.
No,
people try.
They try.
Yeah.
And that's the greatest thing about podcasting I'm finding, and just kind of transition a little bit, is that when you're talking to an audience and when you're talking to people, you have to find out who they are. And that's, you know, for everybody listening, what Pete and I are doing right now is we built rapport. In the beginning, we talked about your background. We talked about this. We find a similarity. That is what rapport building is. I mean, that's Spycraft 101 right there. And that's one of the reasons I wanted Pete on his show, because you can kind of see how you're transitioning from one career field to the next. So all of us veterans out there, LEOs and everything, if you're transitioning, you're kind of learning how you could use your tradecraft and how you could learn what you know to kind of get onto the next phase of your life. And you know, I read Pete's bio, and you guys, I'm going to post Pete's bio after this. He's deployed in almost every one of our efforts since the 90s. Including the, you know, the Bosnias, Iraqi freedom. He's been Afghanistan. Did you do a tour in Africa at all?
I have been to Africa for work. Yes.
There you go. And he's been to Africa. So he's pretty much been in all the hotspots we've seen in the past two decades. I mean, I love it.
Yeah. I have the good fortune of being unfortunate, you know, but, and the thing, because of what I did and how good I was, I did that. And I was out. And I say this all the time, but it remains to be true. It's my job was to meet the most vile, evil people I could meet in a region. And so when I'm doing that, I don't have a professional network that's of any value, you know? So coming back to transition, I didn't work with this general. I didn't talk to this person, you know, the person at whatever contract company. Those guys didn't know me. And if anything, they didn't like me because I was doing what everybody wants to do, but they don't get to do. So I came back with no real network and I had to completely figure it out. And it's not easy.
So tell me about that. So, I mean, and that's kind of a tough transition. And, you know, we were talking about it the other day, like your identity. What do you want your identity to be? And how did you get to the point where you're like, you know what? I've done all these wartime deployments. I've been in some bad situations. I kind of want to... I want to move on to the next phase of my life. So you have an awesome podcast. You have a lot of great guests. How do you get to that point?
A lot of hard work. I mean, it literally is the same blueprint at some level as what I did every day. I get up every day and I talk to people. I get up every day and I process the podcast. No one knows who I am. I didn't come. People will say ask me all the time, like, how do I get paid to do a podcast? And I'm like, first you have to build something that's worth a damn. You know, if you come with an audience, great. Then you're ahead of the game a little bit. I didn't. My friends don't listen to my podcast. Now, some of them do, to be fair. But I know a lot of people, and a lot of people don't listen to my podcast. I had to go find thousands of other Petes out there in the world. And so the only way I know how to do that is to, because I don't have a massive audience. So the only way I know how to do that is to go out and just outwork anybody else alive. And just, I put out 4 episodes a week because that's what it takes for me to get over the hump. And so how do I do? I worked hard. I learned. I brought a lot to the table, and I have a huge head start in terms of like human dynamics and like my baseline for things, Jason, oftentimes is, hey, no one's shooting at me or considering, should I kill that guy or not today? It's all a win. I shouldn't be alive. So when I go to reach out to Tom Hanks, I have no fear of that because what's he going to do? He's still not going to know who I am. So I try in a way that makes sense because I am good at that, but I have no fear of that.
I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, and that's the thing is you got to hustle. And I'm always talking to, like, I do like volunteer work just because I've been in a Fed for a long time, trying to get vets hired that want to get into it. And I always tell them, you got to hustle, you got to network. Just because you did something one time doesn't mean, hey, you know what? That's your credibility the rest of your life. And that is the thing, is you're hustling. You're doing 4 episodes a week. You're building your brand. And that's the greatest thing about it. But the thing is, you're not just doing that. You're helping others while you're doing it. And the biggest reason I got you on here is because you're always helping vets out. You're always helping everybody out. And that's kind of, that's your brand. As much as you don't like it, that is what you, that's who you are, is Pete Turner. You can hit him up any time of night and say, Pete, I need a hand.
Yeah.
It's part of that veteran brotherhood thing. And as much as that's kind of like part of your life in the past, that's going to be your life. You're stuck with it, and it's a good thing. And that's what I love about this. So you're building your brand right now.
Yeah, I'm building my brand. That's for sure. Well, you know, I, the way I look at all of this is if I'm of service and of value to other people, first off, that makes me, there's things that I do that I don't want to do, you know, but I do it because I'm like, I've had so much help. Yeah, this sometimes sucks. And when I say stick your neck out and help a veteran or help someone who's homeless, look, I can't solve the homeless problem. But when I see someone, and I don't have any kind of money, I am by no means, I'm not even poor. I have no money. Okay. But if I have $20, I'm going to buy a dude a meal. You know, like I oftentimes we get in these political conversations, and, you know, I'll jump in because I'm always trying to gather people in what I call the sexy middle. I want the middle to be sexy. And, you know, someone used President Trump's military parade thing, and they used veterans as their lever to make a political argument. And I'm like, how dare you talk about homeless veterans? You know, you don't get to do that when I've almost been homeless. I've been on the edge of homeless so many times, you know, in my survival. Don't use me as your proof that Donald Trump is or isn't a jerk. Don't do that. But what we can do is this group here, as we all fight, is I will go find a veteran right now who has way less than I do. And I will go and give that guy a meal as long as all of us are willing to put money in. And you know how many people offered to do that? None. So I won't do it. I'll go out and I'll try to find people to help. And then when someone, you know, I always lead with, how can I help you? And then if they have something they need, I do it. And if I can't do it, I say, man, I don't know how to do that. You know, we'll have to work on this together. But so rarely does someone ask me for something that I literally can't do. Like, if you want money, I can't do that. I don't have any money. But I have effort. I have desire. I have a powerful network. Can I help you with these things? Can I give you some of my knowledge? I make money producing podcasts. That's what I do. And I get more and more clients all the time. But again, you know, as soon as you get one, you lose one. So it's like this wheel where you're like always trying to catch up. But I always give out advice because I want people to to do this. I want them to create and find their passion, because nobody picks middle management at a corporation for their goal in life, and that shouldn't define you. Yeah, do your job, take care of your family, do all those great things, but everybody wants that great thing in their life. And if it's a podcast, I'm not going to let a little bit of knowledge stand in your way.
And the most random thing, and so I think you kind of hit on it, was well, besides networking, but I had Mark Valley on the other day. And Mark and I are talking offline. I can't remember if it was offline or during the interview. And he's like, yeah, I get this guy named Pete Turner to help me out. And I'm like, Pete helps me out all the time. That's the thing about this veteran community. And that's how we all help each other out. And yeah. I'm noticing that a lot of LEOs and a lot of the first responders, a lot of families that aren't even veterans will help each other. We'll all help each other out. And that's kind of where I'm going with this Protector series, is that we all have a network. We're all going to help each other out. Regardless if we have a dollar in our pocket or we have the knowledge, we're going to use that to help the other people out.
Yeah.
And I can tell you right now, I've been on the media. I've been doing news. I've been doing all sorts of crap. I haven't made a penny out of any of it. And I don't plan to until I actually get to something where I feel is worth it. And yeah, I understand, man. We're all just kind of trying to build content now to try to help each other out.
Yeah, and talking to our Leo partners and our first responders and the military people, we all owe this to each other, but we all owe it to society too. Like, you're a first responder. Well, great. Do more. Find a way to do more and invest in your community in any small way. And in fact, like, me and you investing in each other is investing in our community. When I see your stuff, I'm going to retweet it. I'm not just going to like it. I want to share your content. If people don't like it, they're just going to ignore it. They're not going to get mad at me for sharing it. And if they get mad at me, then they can unfollow me. I don't care. But I want to lift up what you do, what Scott Husing does, what Mark Valley does. And those people are all veterans. But if you're creating something and you want to boost up, I'm going to absolutely retweet your stuff. If I don't, you can go, hey, Pete, will you retweet this? Instantly, yes, I will do it. As soon as I can, I will tweet that thing out. So it's simple stuff like that. Like, if someone takes time to comment on my YouTube channel with my podcast, I'm going to take time to respond. I mean, until I can't do that anymore, which that can happen, then I'm going to respond and at least say thanks or whatever the appropriate response is. And I'm going to do my best to be nice and to not be offended and to try not to offend. But, you can only try those things. You can't always be successful at that. But yeah, share stuff. Get up, you're on Facebook and you see my podcast, share that thing and then bug me and go, Pete, share my thing. And I'm absolutely going to do it. I'm glad to go on people's podcasts. I'm glad to have people on my podcast. Hell, I do four a week. Jason, you and I are going to do a spy versus spy episode on mine.
We are.
Shot.
It's going to be awesome, man. I'm going to pick your brain, and I'm going to hit you like I would when I used to work the Gitmo cases.
Oh man. Yeah. Jesus, I can't even imagine. I always wanted to be a good at interrogation, but I'm so glad I wasn't, because that is such hard, wrenching work. I don't know how you guys do it.
Well, that's a story for another day. We'll do it on your podcast.
All right, that's cool.
So, So what's your next? So, tell me about your podcast.
Okay, so my podcast is it's very much like Joe Rogan's. It's whatever the hell I want. So I have on all kinds of PhDs. I have, it's not about any one thing, but that's because I'm illustrating life. I'm not trying to tell one channel of one story. And I don't dare to think I can tell the Jason Piccolo story in one episode. So I have people back on. I sat next to today, Lorenzo Lamas, and my co-host was Pete Koch. Pete Koch was the Swede in Heartbreak Ridge. He's become a friend of mine. I want to have co-hosts come in because that third person adds a dynamic that you can't find anywhere else. So like, in terms of intelligence, I had Scott Husing on my show as kind of a co-host, but really I had two guests. So he's a ground-owning commander in a battle space like Ramadi. Holy wow. And then I have Michelle Rigby Assad, CIA operator, who's in Iraq at the same time. Now, she didn't own Ramadi, but one of her peers did. And so I got to put the ground commander and the CIA operator together in the same conversation. you know, and that whole thing was facilitated by a ground operator himself. So I'm able to go, Michelle, what did you owe Scott? She's like, oh my God, he's on my shoulder every day and I'm desperate to get him the best information I can. Scott, what does Michelle owe you? Like, oh my God, I'm going to go in whatever door they tell me to go in. It's not my job to wonder whether or not Michelle's done her job. I know she's going to do it. I just have to have faith in that. No one's ever had that conversation on a podcast. So if you want to hear stuff like that, and it's not all war stuff, there's music, there's authors, there's, we have this crazy thing called album fights where we compare and contrast two albums together track by track. So track one takes on track one, track two takes on track two, and it's in a boxing format. So it's a 10-point must scoring system. If you don't understand what I'm saying, don't worry about it. It's awesome. And so this week we have Janet Jackson going against Radiohead because they're both going into the Hall of Fame. And you smash albums together and weird things happen. It's awesome. So my show is about that. And then I do have to plug something that I'm working on personally is a thing called the Prison Chronicles. I went out and talked to a bunch of significant criminals who served life, who were sentenced to something and life or something or life. And they've gotten out. And I'm trying to understand recidivism and what it's like, what happens to someone who becomes a murderer, some kind of other significant crime. And it's jaw-dropping. Whatever you think you know about being an urban kid or a kid who's abused, and then they end up making these life-changing, unforgivable mistakes, whatever you think you know, you don't know. You don't know enough, because the stuff I've heard from talking to regular people is going to blow your mind. So that I'm in the middle of breaking down notes on that. I have all the recording done and that should come out, man, I'm hoping in May, but there's just so much work to get everything edited. But it blows my mind to hear this story and try to do my best to tell it. It's Jason, I'm telling you, it is incredible. And the whole concept of lock him up and throw away the key couldn't be any further from the truth.
You and I talked about that the other night, exactly, because I lost my brother when he was incarcerated, and this whole we could talk a whole show on that, and I'm really looking forward to that one. So you better start hustling.
Hustling's not a problem,
and that's also I can see that becoming a book as well. So
it needs to.
That's definitely going to be a book, man. Definitely.
Yeah, there's so much to learn with that. Just simple, you know, the wisdom of people that have been there and had nothing but time to think and who they are, it's incredible.
Oh, man. Well, we are kind of, we've been talking for a while now. Man, we could probably talk for another 3-4 hours.
Easy, yeah.
But where can we find you?
So on social media, at Pete A. Turner, nice and easy. I'm on Twitter. I will talk to you. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. You know, you can reach out. If you have a question, you're welcome to ask it. I will do my best to answer it. If you get into the range where I got to charge you money, I'll let you know. And then you can go, I don't want to do that. And I'll be like, that's cool. It won't matter. So Pete A. Turner, I'm on LinkedIn. I've got a zillion connections. Feel free to connect. My job is to say yes and help people out and tell stories. And if that sounds like something you need help with, by all means, let me know.
Well, Pete Turner is now going to be my first friend of the show. I've always wanted to say that. I have like a 12 friends of the show. They don't know it yet, but they're going to be they're going to be on there. But yeah, Pete, really, thanks a lot.
Yeah,
thanks for coming on.
Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much. And we're going to have you on my show just as soon as I can clear my schedule. It's going to happen soon.
Good luck with that. Thanks, Pete.